Good morning. Our office administrator, Tanya, seems to have like an uncanny intuition when she chooses the color of the order of services. It always fits in some unexpected way with something somebody's wearing or some display on the front, and I just noticed this was just made for Vicky today. Well, here's a story for all ages that was told on the west side of the mountains by the Clackamas Chinook people. This is a story for all ages. This is before we segregated stories into stories for children and stories for adults. It's called, these days, The Skookum and the Wonderful Boy. A skookum is a monster, something like Bigfoot. On the east side of the falls, near today's Oregon City, there was a large fishing village with a great chief. But from the east side, there came a frightful skookum. See, east side has always been pretty scary to the west side. A frightful skookum who destroyed the village and killed the chieftain along with all the people, except the chief's wife and her unborn son. Later she gave birth, and to make him great and strong, she took him to streams and lakes filled with powerful spirits and bathed him in the waters. From these he absorbed strength and grew prodigiously. So this idea of water and spirits is found in many traditions, not just the New Testament with Jesus and John the Baptist doing their thing down at the Jordan River. In the course of time, the boy began to ask his mother about the things he saw in their lodge. She replied, "This is the spear your father used to catch the salmon. This is the tomahawk he used to kill his enemies or to split wood. And this is the bow that he used to shoot arrows." Taking the tomahawk, the boy went out and soon met the skookum. He drove his tomahawk into a gnarly log of wood to make a crack and cried out to the giant, "If you're so strong, hold this crack open while I take another stroke." The witless skookum placed his fingers in the crack, and the boy pulled out his tomahawk. The crack closed, the skookum was trapped, and the boy killed him easily. Then, taking his father's bow, the youngster shot an arrow into the sky, crying, "Let those who died come to life." Scarcely had the arrow fallen before the old chief and all his people were seen coming up the river in their canoes. Landing at the rocks, they began fishing as if nothing had happened. The wonderful boy rejoiced to see his father and went down among the fishermen with a look of triumph. But the old chief struck him in the face and said, "Who are you? I'm chief here." Instead of thanks for dispatching their adversary and bringing them back to life, the boy is driven out by those we'd most expect to be grateful. That's pretty Easter-y, too. You remember how Jesus never felt at home in his hometown, but had to keep on moving. The wonderful boy was very upset. He went to the rocks above the falls and began weeping. His tears falling on each side of the falls wore two great holes in the rock, which may be seen there to this day. Deciding that he would no longer live as a man, the boy changed himself into a fish. The falls roared so loudly that he swam upstream to the Tualatin, but could not yet rest on account of the roaring water. So he proceeded to the mouth of the Mulala, and then the Pudding River, and then the Yamhill, but still he found no resting place. Finally, he reached the clear Santiam. Here he found what he desired and went to sleep in a still pool that was changed, and there was changed into a rock shaped like a salmon. And this accounts for the fact that no salmon that ascend the falls at Oregon City ever turn aside into any of the streams until they reach the Santiam. There they see the rock, take a circle, and saluting it with a flip of their tail, proceed up the crystal clear river until they reach the pebbly bars that are perfect for their spawning grounds. Imagine the pictures Maurice Sendak might have drawn to illustrate this story. You can do that while we sing. Thank you. hymn number 21, For the Beauty of the Earth. Thank you. Such a sweet hymn. Well, can we have a show of hands? Who remembers someone reading Where the Wild Things Are to you as a child? A good number. Who remembers reading it to your own children or someone else's? A little bigger number kind of gives us a picture of the age spread. Okay. To grandchildren? Who's read it to grandchildren? There's one. Is there anyone who never heard it before today? Wow. Some people never heard Where the Wild Things Are. Interesting. What was your favorite? What's that?
I said he's from Canada.
From Canada, right. What are you going to do? And yet you look a bit like Maurice Sendak. Interestingly enough. What was your favorite children's story? Anybody?
Little Engine That Could.
Ferdinand the Bull.
A Very Hungry Caterpillar.
A Very Hungry Caterpillar.
Pixie Dough?
Mixie Dough. Mixie Dough. Okay. Baking book.
Yurtle the Turtle.
Go Dogs Go. Go Dogs Go. Right, right. Who's your favorite author? Favorite children's book author?
Robert Louis Stevenson.
Dr. Seuss. Dr. Seuss.
Bill Peet.
A.A. Milne. A.A. Milne. Anybody else? One more? Well, mine was probably Dr. Seuss for the youngest reading. When our son was born, Pam and I immediately set about acquiring all of the picture books that we remembered from childhood. Of course, we got Where the Wild Things Are and Cat in the Hat and McGilligot's Pool. It's an early Dr. Seuss book about hope and trust and fishing. Obviously, it imprinted me for life. Some we purchased new. Some we retrieved from Pam's family home just before her mother died. Mom hadn't wanted to let go of those books all at once when she got sick. Like many things in the house, they were a comfort to her while she was holding on. Well, children's books become precious to all who are fortunate enough to have had them in our homes. And we know that's not everyone. But they're like modern scriptures. We read them over and over like holy books are read. And they shape us like those books help to shape religious communities. But while children's books may take us for a wild ride with Mr. Toad and his motor car, or Max and the Wild Things, they're usually much gentler than scriptures. Their imagined communities of people or animals or both are inclusive, where those who might begin as opponents usually find a way to get along. Not always true of scriptures, I'm afraid. But we learn these books by heart. We know them like we know living people. And the best of them seem to know us already when we're first exposed to them. That's a sacred quality. I don't know what else to call it. Such words and pictures become part of our growing up environment as much as the rooms and yards and sidewalks around us. The best look simple, but don't think that that's easy to achieve. I read an article a few years ago by someone who had worked in the children's division of a major publishing house. She spoke of the dread she would feel when she saw a cover letter introducing a manuscript as a Dr. Seuss type story. Sing-song silliness plus sappy song stories do not equal Seuss. Not at all. What Dr. Seuss, Maurice Sendak, Tomi de Paula, and the other greats do with their work may look simple, but that's not easy to accomplish. Of course, not all the books that become precious to us are great. Some just came from the grocery store. Some have a particular picture, a particular scene that gets inside of us where we'll go on holding and holding it. till the day we die. Books become precious, and so do places, and for many of the same reasons. A place can also be full of stories and memories and dreams. You go there. It calls you back. It follows you home. You go to sleep, and suddenly in the middle of the night, you're back in that place on a sunny day, finding something or looking for it, though you don't know what it is, tossing pebbles, maybe fishing. A special place of yours. Go there now. You might want to close your eyes. Just a quick visit. Okay, don't get too involved. You gotta come back. Where'd you go? Where'd you go? Anybody? Nikki?
I went to a river where we used to go camping, and I always gathered little guppies and stuff from the river.
A river where she used to go and gather guppies with a cup. Waterfall in the White Pass. Wow.
An engine, and they opened the doors to the firebox. It was frightening.
Wow. And did you hear that? An engine. They opened the door to the firebox, a train engine, right? And it was frightening, because this is probably a coal-fired train. Wow. Wow, the memories we have here. Yeah.
A tree I used to climb to escape doing dishes.
The escape tree. All right, good place to be. No escaping here. Good place to be. Trees have many purposes. They serve us well. Well, I went to one of my favorite spots on the Santiam, the same river where the wonderful boy had gone after creating Willamette Falls and becoming a salmon. Every place on that river has been someone's favorite place for thousands of years, or maybe tens of thousands. This place where I went has several huge boulders, the largest one right in the middle. Salmon and steelhead sometimes pause there on the way to their spawning beds upstream. Fishermen have a chance to catch one, if they're lucky. I got there one bright morning right after a Memorial Day, and I saw some flowers on the bank near the boulder. Not local wildflowers, these were roses. But I didn't pay them much attention. My mind was on fish, and so I went further up and started fishing. As I worked my way back downstream to the boulder, standing in the water in my waders, I noticed a little cut in the bank where the water was fairly still, right by the flowers. Something white, I mean really radiantly white, like powder was covering a small section of the gravel. Well, that's odd. What natural substance could be so pure, bone white? What could it be? Well, the answer, of course, is bones. The calcium and the other minerals that make up human remains. They were someone's cremains, which are fairly heavy and don't disperse even in fast-moving rivers quite as quickly or efficiently as we might expect or hope they would. Maybe you've experienced this yourself. Of course, in my line of work, I've experienced it a few times. They don't quite go away as fast as you wish. Maybe this was a soldier who had died in one of our recent wars, or an older one. It had just been Memorial Day. But soldier or not, she or he had likely been someone who loved that spot like I do, to fish it or just to sit and look up at sky and water. There's a deep hole near the big boulder, and I was starting to cast when I noticed a big male curved-jawed salmon. They're called bucks, while females are called hens. Kind of, I don't know, manly stuff, and gets into fishing sometimes. It was holding in about 4 feet of water. It was battered, dark. Little white spots are beginning to form on its body, like the ick infections that aquarium fish can get. Probably spawned out, probably in the last day or two of life. Probably not too good to eat, but I hadn't yet caught a salmon after so many attempts, and I thought this one might taste okay after brining and smoking, if I could just get him to bite. So first, I try a lure that should look like food, but the fish takes no interest. I can almost hear it say, "I'm not hungry. I'm holding in the water." Next, I try a lure that flashes big and bright like a rival buck that's chasing a laying hen. But no, I'm not fighting now. Not fighting. I'm holding. Holding the water. I try something that's designed to look like a rival's eggs, which many fish will destroy in order to better the chances that their eggs will survive and their genes triumph. But no, again, I'm not even protecting my line of offspring at this point. I'm just holding on. And has that little wiggle going. I can't say if the fish looks peaceful or sad. He's just holding. Not too many animals have such a dramatic reproductive scheme. Hatched high in a mountain stream, migrating to the ocean, sailing the world for a few years, then returning to the same spot to spawn and die. I saw it happen once. I think I did. A spawned out whitehead, or sorehead as the Santiam locals call the fungus-covered ones. One of those soreheads had been holding near me for the better part of an hour. I'd learned by then not to bother casting near such fish. But then came a moment when the fish just rolled on its side and let go. Floated downstream. I couldn't see whether it started swimming again or not, or if it had really let go of life for good. Let go. Let go for the good of the species, the good of the other wild things that use dead salmon for food and for the health of the rivers themselves that depend on the nutrients their bodies leave behind, like the cremains, in a way. Let go so more life can come. Now, steelhead are another fish that live in the same streams. They make the same ocean trip and the same return journey. They look like salmon, but if they survive to make it home, there's a good chance that they'll get to go and do it all over again. Unless I catch them. I've had better luck on the Santiam with steelhead than with salmon. But speaking of luck, are steelhead luckier than salmon? Nature won't say. But all this got me thinking. Could I write a children's book about a salmon and a steelhead spawned in the same river in the very same gravel bed who become fast friends for life? Kind of children's bookie. Should I have two pairs? Maybe a buck and a hen of each species? There's that funny language of deer for males and chickens for females again. Buck and hen. Or maybe that would be too complex. Probably so. I'll stick with two males since I know something about first being something like a boy and later on being something like a man. Which brings me to the question of how human they should be, both in the drawing and the writing. How human? How fishy? They have to be human enough so parents and children will care and relate to them. Fishy enough to make some of the difficult parts of what's coming feel safe. That's one of the reasons why we use animals in stories. What happens to them might be too much for us if it happened to people. So they'll be fairly human in my book, with human speech and just enough fish biology to let us talk about the difference in the two species' life cycles. For names, how about Sammy and Steve? Sammy the Salmon, Steve Steelhead. I don't know. Anyway, they meet as small fry up on the North Santiam shortly before they hatch on adjacent gravel beds in that crystal clear water. They frolic and play and maybe compete a little for bugs and things, but become friends in ways that real fish never would. It's a children's story, after all. As they get bigger, they begin moving downstream, avoiding dangers like adult fish and osprey and herons that would eat them if they could, and will eat many of their friends. They're inseparable until they reach the ocean, where they find that now they must separate as they follow different currents to complete their adult development. "Something tells me to turn this way," says Sammy. "Something tells me to turn that way," says Steve, and they say their fond farewells. "Good luck, safe journey, wherever." Off they go on their ocean voyages. I don't know, should they have adventures at different ports of call as they sail the seven seas? Yeah, I think that would make things too complex and too long for the kind of book that I read to kids on Sundays. You could have a couple of multi-panel pages with wordless ocean scenes. That should be enough. Maybe see a whale, see an octopus. What matters most, though, is the reunion at the mouth of the Columbia. "Sammy! Steve! I never thought I'd see you again. Look! Look out!" A sea lion lunges for one of them, but both friends escape. On they swim up the great river until it meets the Willamette. They pass the fish ladder at the falls, where there's a viewing window that allows state workers to keep track of their numbers. This might be the only appearance of people in the story. Maybe a backlit figure holding a clipboard. "What in the world is that?" asks Steve. "I have no idea," says Sammy. "Nasty looking thing." They both agree. At last, they reach the mouth of the Santiam, south of Salem, and make their final turn. Our last few pages have had a greenish-brownish tint to suggest the more turbid Willamette. But now there's perfect clarity, and the two friends notice how they've changed. Steve's sides have a bright red stripe. Sammy is darker and redder, too, but there's more. "Sammy, you should see yourself. Your mouth is much bigger, and it's curved. And your teeth, they're huge. Your teeth are bigger, huge. Not as big as yours, I'm sure. But the strange thing is, I'm not hungry." "Well, neither am I. What's happening?" "I don't know. But look, do you see where we are?" And now they're back at the gravel beds where the story began. I'm not sure how to handle their encounter with the females of the species. Maybe this would be a good time for another silent page split in two panels for each sexual encounter, maybe showing some eggs and a cloud of sperm in the water, much less dense than those white cremains I'd found nearby. Let parents reading the story say as much or as little as they want about that. Well, spawning accomplished and tastefully illustrated, I hope, Steve goes looking for his friend. There's Sammy by the big boulder, holding his position in a slow part of the current. "Sammy, there you are. Wasn't that something? I didn't know I had it in me, whatever it was that came out." I can imagine the editor will now send me a cautionary note about that line, and I'd have to change it. "More sing-song silliness, less sperm, please, Mr. Morrow." "But I'm hungry now, aren't you?" "Really hungry." "Let's go looking for something to eat, okay, Sammy? Sammy? Sammy?" But Sammy just keeps holding where he is. "We could float downstream and gobble up some of those round red things we passed on the way. What do you say?" "No, Steve. I'll just stay here, holding in the water." "But why, Sammy? Don't you want to go back down to the sea again? Aren't there things you want to see again and eat, like shrimps and crabs?" "No, Steve. I'm holding. Holding. Just just holding in the water. I'm looking at Fran now because I'm thinking of Frank. When we saw him, how he was holding. Sammy, says Steve, you keep holding there. I have to find something to eat. I really have to. And then I'll be back. Steve crisscrosses the riverbed, gobbling up whatever he can find, heading downstream quite some distance. And feeling better, he starts to swim back to where he left Sammy. When he gets there, Sammy's gone. We know he's let go. And Steve the Steelhead feels it too. Should we show Sam's lifeless body or the vultures that circle the real river in real life during the yearly spawning run? Maybe not. I think that our last picture of Sammy should simply show him holding in the water. I guess that's not an ending. I don't have any words for it yet. Maybe this should be another silent page. Maybe we could show my boots in the water. Somewhere near the boulder, right next to the patch of bone dust in the gravel. Or maybe not. I haven't been in the story up to now. I've just been nearby holding and watching it unfold. Well, my story isn't finished yet. I'll never be Dr. Seuss or Maurice Sendak, but I hope it will someday be good enough to read to a child. What's it about? Not fishing, not spawning, not about fish, really. It's really about love. About love and about holding. Children love to be held while we read to them. Our principles affirm the universe as an interdependent web that's not just about being, but also about holding. And then after that last principle, there's a blank space, a silence. Could we read that as an eighth principle that's all about letting go? Letting go so a greater good can come. What greater good could that be? Happy Easter to you all. It's a wonderful day to remember that there are many more stories of death and renewal, not necessarily in place of, but in addition to the one we've heard so often. Remember how the wonderful boy's mother bathed him in different lakes and streams so he could absorb their spirits? There's so many spirits, and stories are waiting to be found. Still out there, holding, and waiting to be told. But for my part, I'll let go now.